Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisbee.
I'm Kirsty Dull.
And this is the podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, what have you been reading on time this week?
Well, normally every series you do a bit of poetry, and it's my turn this time. I've read some poetry. I've been reading Time as a Mother by Ocean Vuong, which was published earlier this year by Cape Poetry, I think. I never feel confident talking about poetry. I think the hangover from my degree, where poetry was always the bit I found hardest out of, you know, the stuff I was reading for my degree. And I think it just is so easy to kind of convince yourself that poetry is hard. So I have been trying to make more of an effort to read more poetry in a kind of, I can read poetry. Of course I can read poetry. We can all
read poetry. Everybody can read poetry, yes.
Everybody can read poetry. So I have been reading some poetry. It's beautiful in a kind of harrowing sort of way. Have you read any of his poetry or his novel?
Yes, my 16-year-old bought me Night Sky with Exit Wounds for Christmas, and I think on Christmas Day, so my mum and dad had bought me one of those, you know, the bath tray things that you put across it. You can put your like wine and your crisps and whatever on it. So I got in the bath and read it cover to cover in the bath on Christmas Day, which is a delightful image for all of you. So I like to share that with you. But yeah, I think he's amazing.
Yeah, I read his novel, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, but I'd not read any of his poetry before. So this was a slight impulse purchase, but I'm really glad I read it. And it's incredibly moving. So it's all been written sort of after the death of his mother, and it covers all sorts of things really connected, that some stuff directly about his mum, some stuff is about sort of someone really struggling after a big life event like this. There's stuff about relationships with other people. There's, you know, in the sort of close past through to more distant. It covers a huge amount, lots of kind of, the thing that struck me reading the whole collection was sort of how much of it was other people, like talking to other people, or the narrator talking to other people. Is narrator the right word for poetry? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
they're still narrating, aren't they? I think, again, there's this sort of idea of poetry as this very insular thing, this very kind of internal, and there is a lot of internal stuff, but actually a lot of it is conversation. A lot of it is dialogue, you know, kind of in dialogue with other people and other people around him. But I am going to do, a small reading. One of the poems, and actually I've changed my mind about which one I was going to read right up until like minutes ago. So the one I'm going to read is called Amazon History of a Former Nail Salon Worker. March, Advil, brackets, ibuprofen, 4-pack. Sally Henson pink nail polish, 6-pack. Clorox bleach, industrial size. Diane hairpins, 4-pack. Seafoam handheld mirror, I love New York t-shirt, white, small. April, Nongshim ramen noodle bowl, 24-pack. Cotton balls, 100 count. Thank you for your loyalty cards, 30 count. Tulene POR 15-40-404 solvent, 1 quart. UV LED nail lamp, cuticle oil value pack, clear acrylic nail tips, 500 count. May, Advil, ibuprofen, 4-pack. Vicks Vapor Rub, twin pack. Portable electric nail drill. Salon Pass heat activated muscle patch, 40 count. Lipstick, Night Out Red. Little Debbie chocolate zebra cakes, 4 boxes. June, large faux clay planter pots value set. Carnation condensed milk, 6-pack. Clear nail art acrylic liquid powder. Dish bowl, 2 pieces. Birthday card, sun. Pop-up mother and son effect. Nike Elite basketball shorts, men's, small. July, Savaland holographic gold nail powder, 6 colours. Nescafe Tater's Choice instant coffee. Advil ibuprofen, 4-pack. Pixnor pedicure double-sided callus remover. Bengay medicated cream, 3-pack. August, new chic ochre summer dress florals print, size 6. Wrigley's double mint gum, 8-pack. Plastic Adirondack lawn chair, colonial blue. September, nail buffers and files, 10 pieces. Coppertone sunblock, 6 ounces. October, Cozy Nights fleece blanket, pink. Sleep easy, melatonin caps, 90 count. Icy hot maximum strength pain relief pads. November, Tampax, 24 count. Faux resin hair clips, 3-pack. December, Advil ibuprofen maximum strength, 4-pack. True Grow tulip bulbs, 24 pieces. February, Healthline compact trigger release folding walker. Yankee Candle, Midsummer Nights, large jar. March, Hemoglam cotton headscarf, sunrise pink. White socks, women's small, 12-pack. April, Chemoglam cotton scarf, flower garden print. Warrior Mum, breast cancer awareness t-shirt, pink and white. May, Muller 255 lumbar support back brace. June, birthday card, son, we will always be together, Snoopy design. July, Eternity aluminium urn, dove and rose engraved, small. Perfect memories picture frame, 8x11 inch, black. Burt Bees lip balm, honey, 1-piece. August. September, Easy Grow Windowsill Herb Garden. October, Your Story Customised Memorial Plaque, 10x8x4 inch. Winter coat, navy blue, extra small. November, wool socks, grey, 1 pair.
Oof.
Oh. So, like, it's just, you know, that kind of, it's just that the kind of banality of some of it, this watching it change over time, the how our bloody Amazon shopping list reveals far too much about us. I just say it's an astonishing collection. There's so much stuff I underlined and so much stuff that I could read out and won't, because I'd just be here the whole time and I think that'd probably be a copyright issue. But yeah, really astonishing collection, and I need to go back and read his first one now.
Yes, do. It's brilliant. I do want that. I've been waiting for it to come out in paperback. Yeah, because I won't read poetry on my Kindle unless I have to, because I think sometimes it knocks the line space.
Yeah, out. Formatting can go weird.
Yes, yeah. So I'm waiting for the paperback, but I will definitely read that.
But what have you been reading? Everything, I think.
Yeah, I've been reading quite a lot because I'm chairing a lot at the minute. Yes, and I actually, this is a book that I am chairing on Monday, but I am talking about it because I absolutely fucking loved it. So it's called The Black Locomotive by Ryan Hughes, and some people might know that Ryan Hughes, his first novel, XX, came out a couple of years ago. It's massive. It's like 1,000 pages. This is much shorter at 300, and I think it's 96, something like that. So yeah, published by Picador. And Ryan Hughes is a graphic designer. He works on loads of different, he's worked on loads of different comics. I think he started his career at Smash Hits back in the day.
Tin of questions.
I won't be mentioning the facts that I used to buy that when I was a kid. He was already working on it. But yeah, so The Black Locomotive's been compared to J.G. Ballard because it's sci-fi set in the city. So it's in London, and what's happening is that this team of people who are led by a guy called, I'm just going to check I get his name the right way around, Austin Arnold. They are basically digging to make this to make an extra section of Crossrail, and they come across this massive, like, cavernous space. They can't go any further because there's this like cathedral size gap where there should be like tunnel to tunnel through. So they have to stop work, and obviously it all has to be checked out. And they've got this other person working with them, Rutherford, who is an artist. He's got access to all areas. He, when they manage to open the hatch that they find within, once they get in there and they're exploring it, they find this hatch. And when they manage to get that open and gas comes out, Rutherford goes in, whereas everybody else has run off. Eventually they realise that he's disappeared and they can't get in there, and he's off. But Rutherford's... So one of the things that Hughes does, because he's a graphic designer, is that he has all Rutherford's designs in here. So there's loads of CADs, so computer-aided design pages, where he's showing different things that you might have as part of a city, different sort of buildings, different engineering parts. He's also got loads of photographs in here that are supposed to be ones that Rutherford's taken. So there's that whole dimension of it. And part of this is about how buildings affect people, what impacts they have on us. But the other sort of part of the story is, once Rutherford disappears and he is down this, is in this cavern that I'm not going to say too much about because I don't want to spoil it. They have to find another way to get in because he's taking the key with him. Mm. So what they do is that Austin is part of a group called the Smokebox Crew, and he has been part of this group since he was young. And he calls on one of his friends who was part of this because he knows that they will have a way that they can get in. And this involves a locomotive, which is under Box Hill. So there are loads of locomotives. Apparently, all these locomotives we've been told have been decommissioned are under there in perfect working order. They've been looked after. And they set off to try and save the city in this locomotive. The other thing that I loved about Smokebox Crew was that they have their own song. And there's a QR code in the book. And if you click on the QR code, which I was obviously desperate to do because I'm like, where's this going to take me? You get to Bandcamp, and some of Ryan Hughes's friends have recorded a version of the song so you can listen to it. And it sort of describes as, it's set up as like the original 7-inch that was sent out to members in like 60 whatever or whatever it is. And then there are two remixes that were done for the paperback that were done by Baby Daddy from the Scissors. So I am desperate to ask him how he knows Baby Daddy. What's the connection there? That's wild. But I loved, so all the stuff, I love stuff that's metatextual and has got all these different elements to it. So I really enjoyed all the stuff where, you know, Rutherford's taken all these photos and done all these designs and what have you. But the Smokebox Crew was just brilliant because it's this like fandom. He's been part of it since he was a kid. They've now evolved, so obviously they don't write letters to each other that go out in these fanzines anymore. They've got an app that you have to know about. You have to be invited to be on it. And as they set off, they need the points changing along the way to make sure that they can get through to London. And so they put a notice up, and they have no idea. Everyone's got pseudonyms, so they've got no idea who the other people are. And Hughes gives us an insight to some of the other people who are part of the group. And he does a really brilliant job of them not being the stereotype, you know, like mm-hmm. the people you might be thinking of that would be part of a train crew. They are not those people. And he does such a brilliant job of showing us who some of these people are who were involved in it. So it means we get these like two old guys who one of them's in a wheel, they're in a nursing home, one of them's in a wheelchair, and they manage to escape in an Uber to go and sort out. And they get the Uber driver to do the work for him because obviously they can't do it, but they're so excited, like he's jumping up and down in his wheelchair because they managed to get there in time. And we've got this kid in London who's part of a gang and they're robbing a shop, and when he gets the message and he has to go and like he has to make a decision at that point because he's not been like active in the Smokebox Crew for a while. So it's, does he help him, does he not help him? This couple of Asian girls who were at school, so there's all these like characters that are only in it for a tiny bit to play their part. So there's some really interesting stuff about community and technology and how we work together to like save something or not. And obviously there's a whole sci-fi side of it as well, which is what comes out of where Rutherford's ended up, I'm not going into that too much, but he does use Z and Z pronouns in that bit as well. So there's all sorts of like interesting things going on in it. And yeah, the only thing I would say is that the ending's not tied up in a nice neat bow. It leaves a bit of a like cliffhanger at the end. I'm not sure there's anything coming after. I think it's meant to be a sort of what does humanity need to do type ending to it. So some people, I know some people don't like it if they don't have the nice neat endings. But yeah, I loved it. I've had a total blast reading it over the last couple of days. So that's my recommendation for this week.
Yeah, I think that sounds great. I always think that I'm not a science fiction reader. But if I've learned anything this evening is that I shouldn't be scared of poetry and I shouldn't be scared of science fiction. And in fact, maybe I should just read books.
Yeah, well, I think as well, I'm speculating here, but I think the reason I've been asked to chair the event for this is because we did do some sci-fi last series.
We did.
When we did, I can't remember what it's called, that one that I really didn't like and you really did.
Oh, the Jacqueline Hartman.
Yes, and Akeen Balugan's stories, which I did love. So, yeah, because Akeem does quite a lot with off the shelf, so I think... maybe that's led them to our little episode there and to me being into sci-fi. So
wow, hurrah. I will, no, but genuinely that sounds, I love all the kind of I love what I tend to love in books is character and how people kind of react to each other and how people work together, and that from that point of view sounds really, really interesting, and I should just not be scared of, you know, things threatening the state of humanity. I mean, any more than our current government. We're recording this on the day that the Home Secretary has resigned, the Prime Minister has not voted on something that she called. Possibly by the time we finish recording this podcast, there won't be a government anymore. So actually, when I talk about a threat to humanity, we could be elected in charge by the time we're finished.
Just before we start recording, my boyfriend was watching BBC News and there was whoever they were talking to for the commentary was saying that they didn't know whether, so the word was that both the chief and the deputy whip had resigned, but they didn't know whether they'd resigned or whether they'd been sacked or whether they'd been reinstated or whether they were still, I'm just like, and part of me wonders why we're talking about it, because this is going to make no sense by the time this podcast goes out, because we probably won't even have a government at that point, so.
The lettuce will be in charge by the time this podcast goes out. So, on to Crime Week. Speaking of criminals.
I have to confess as well, before we start talking about the books, that I told a lie last week, because I said we hadn't done any crime last series, and the two books that we are doing this week is a direct response to one of the crime books we read last series. So we read Nicola, can't remember her surname, come and help me out, Kirsty.
Williams.
We read Nicola Williams' book that I can't remember the title of either.
Oh, we're doing so well.
Yes.
Without Judgment.
Thank you. We read Nicola Williams' book, which was about a black lawyer, and part of the conversation we had was about the lack of lawyers of colour in fiction. So I deliberately went out to look for two books about lawyers of colour in fiction, and that's what we are talking about this week. So there we go. I apparently am as bad as the government.
Indeed. Okay, so I think the first bit we're going to talk about is Take It Back by Kia Abdullah, which is published by HQ, now in paperback. This is about a woman called Zara Khalil, who has been a barrister, has been a very successful barrister, but has given up the prestige and the hefty paycheck and has gone to work for a charity or a service, kind of service for victims of sexual assault, and sort of advocating for them and supporting them. And she's got lots of, you know, there's one particular sort of friend who is still a barrister, who occasionally has drinks with her and is just like, why did you give it up? Like, are you mad? And her saying, you know, actually, I've got a lot more meaning in my work and so on and so forth. And then someone who comes to see her is a teenage girl. She's 16, called Jodie Wolfe. Now, she is a white working class teenage girl who has a very severe facial disfigurement. She has a condition called, you said it earlier,
neurofibromatosis. It's the same condition that the elephant man had.
There you go. So she has quite pronounced facial differences, which means that she has had quite a lot of bullying at school and quite a lot of, you know, basically a lot of unpleasantness that she's had to deal with as a result of that. And she comes to Zara accusing four boys in her year at school of rape, and those four boys are Muslim. And this then becomes a case that gets a lot of public attention for one reason or another. And you've got Zara, who absolutely believes Jodie, believes everything she says, believes that she's been raped by these four boys, or by three of them and one watched, sort of thing. And you've got a colleague of hers in the advocacy service who has interviewed one of the boys, who, and they deny that this took place. They said that they weren't particularly nice to her. They made fun of her, but there was certainly no rape. And she believes the boys. So essentially what it comes down to, the vast majority of the book is the court case. You've got the word of Jodie against the word of these four boys, and interspersed with all the courtroom scenes, you see Zara dealing with her family. She's got, you know, there's a lot of kind of complex family issues where her, you know, her brother in particular is very bitter about some stuff that Zara has sort of done in the past, that Zara has had opportunities that he has not had, or that Zara has achieved where he hasn't achieved. You know, you've then got issues around her, Zara and her kind of on-off casual boyfriend, who obviously wants it to be more than that, and Zara is very kind of keeping people at distance. And then you kind of get into the much bigger societal issues of the press having a field day, because you've got four Muslim boys being accused of the rape of a white disabled girl. You've also got kind of all the racial tensions. You've got, you know, what looks like the EDL or something similar, you know, protesting the you know, just Muslims or brown people in general. But you've also got sort of members of the Muslim community who are very angry at Zara for having taken the case, for not sort of, you know, basically for being on the white girl side rather than defending these four Muslim boys who come from good, upstanding families, who, you know, by all, you know, by the looks of it, are very respectable, you know, young men kind of thing. So there's lots of different tensions going along all at the same time. I have talked for quite a while. Where do you want to start?
I mean, I always want to start with the white working class thing, because I texted you, I was about two chapters in and I had gone, oh no. Because she makes it into a really complex and interesting case. However, Jodie's mother, Christine, is absolute white trash, lives in a council flat, alcoholic, is vile to her daughter, blames her for her father leaving, is in poverty. Jodie's basically having to look after herself. She is like the epitome of this is the, you know, Daily Mail, white, this is what the white working class looked like. And it drove me, oh, absolutely nuts. So I don't know whether that's the best place to start. I don't want to put people off reading the book because actually I think it's interesting and well done. And until I got to the penultimate chapter, which really annoyed me before it redeemed itself in the final chapter in some senses, that did my head in. It really, really annoys me because I'm like, there were really interesting nuanced portraits of, I think, all of the other characters. And I'm like, if you're going to go for somebody white, like, not, don't stereotype the working classes, like,
Yeah, I found her mum really frustrating, and I found the kind of prominence in the copy of her mother really off-putting, because I have to say, when I kind of looked at, as I went to put this book to read it for the podcast, when I looked at the book, like the I'll see if I can find it actually. So in the copy, it says the victim, a 16-year-old girl with facial deformities, neglected by an alcoholic mother who accuses the boys of something unthinkable. And I saw that at the top of the copy and I just went, I don't know if I can read this because, you know, family with alcohol problems, mother with alcohol problems. I was just like, I just don't know if I can read about a teenage girl with an alcoholic mother, because that's incredibly triggering for me. But I was like, no, we're doing it for the podcast. I've said we'll read it. I'm going to read it. I will put my big brave pants on, and I will go forth. Actually, the mother is an incredibly minor character. And you only see her maybe three times in the book. I mean, she's horrendous every time you see her. But I don't know. I felt like the copy didn't do it any favours, because actually the mother doesn't need to be there.
Yeah.
Like, yes, there's stuff around the fact that her mother outright accuses Jodie of lying. She absolutely doesn't believe her, is horrendous to her. And I know it is scene setting in the sense of, here is a young girl who is desperate for attention and love, you know, for those, because there are people that don't believe Jodie. For those people who don't believe Jodie's story about the four boys, I can see that that is scene setting and giving more, you know, why would a girl make up something like this? Well, because she's neglected and she's desperate for love and attention. But I just felt like that character, the alcoholic mother, didn't need to be there. Like, that could have been done. Yeah. And then you would have avoided some of those issues that you're talking about.
Yeah, and also her best friend doesn't believe her. So her best friend Nina is awful. She's one of those kids, she reminds me of, you know, when like you're at school and you've got that friend who's not really your friend. It's a frenemy situation, isn't it?
Really? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Depends, like, I don't think she's pretending to be a friend. I just think she's an arsehole. So she's really pretty. And part of the whole thing is that she's got Jodie dressed up in her clothes on the night that the alleged rape happens, and she's just like, she don't believe her friend, she does some vile stuff.
She doesn't believe her, she testifies against her in court. And then phones her up and goes, look, I don't believe you, but there's some people saying really horrible things about you online, you might want to report them. So it felt, you know, it was that sort of, I mean, I guess it, in a way, it was a sort of very good portrait of the fickleness of teenage girls, of, you know, I think you're lying, but this bit isn't fair. But yeah, no, she was good. I mean, what I think, I mean, all of that, I mean, I feel like I'm just sort of getting my complaint out early. I actually think it was a good book. I think it's one of the better thrillers I've read recently.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, the mother annoyed me.
once I got into it, I thought it was very good. And I feel like what I've done here is just centered the white characters. But I just need to have a rant about people writing white working class characters and like, ugh. Anyway. But yeah, no, I thought it was really good. And I was thinking about, you know, we've talked before about reveals and twists. And in this, there was actually a couple of really good, shocking twists in it where I was just like, oh my God. So that, like, plotting wise, I thought it was really well done. I thought the other characters were really interesting. I put a bit of a question mark over Zara and the whole keeping everybody at arm's length stuff, which just feels a bit like it's like the new version of the middle-aged detective who goes home and is divorced and in it.
He's a maverick. He plays by his own rules. That felt to me very much like setting her up for a series, and there is at least one other book with her in it which I absolutely want to read. I mean, I think, you know, I'm there, I will read that book. But I think on the whole, actually, the kind of backstory setting up, all the stuff with her family, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of tension with Zara's family, with, you know, expectations, family expectations, community expectations, the expectations she puts upon herself as well. There's the kind of, you know, the idea that, so there's one of the things I underlined in it, there's this bit really, really close to the beginning where she says all her life she was told that if she worked hard and treated people well, she'd get there. No one told her that when she got there, there'd be no there.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a really good description of that sort of, you're attaining and you're achieving and you're achieving, and actually you achieve everything that you can possibly achieve, and then you go, well, why did I do that? And I thought that made her a really interesting character, that there was this sort of, there's obviously this drive in her. There has to be a drive to achieve that sort of success in terms of law. But there's obviously been a point at which she's gone, I'm out, and she's gone to do something that's much more worthwhile rather than lucrative. And I want more of that backstory. And I hope that in the next book and in future books, you do start to get some more of that backstory out, because there was enough in there for me to go, yeah, I'm interested in you as a character.
Yeah, I felt like she'd not quite worked out what she did want, that this was a, she'd gone sideways for something that she thought she could do rather than, yes. So I was
intrigued. Yeah, maybe.
About what else was there. I'll tell you who else really intrigued me, and she has a tiny role in it, but one of the boys, Hassan, who's quite violent, and there's definitely like loads of stuff around toxic masculinity.
Yeah, for sure.
But when they're accused of the rape and they're arrested for it, they know that the police are going to come round to houses, and Hassan's mum takes all the technological equipment out of his room, puts it in a Tupperware box and buries it in the garden. She also gets rid of his clothes that he was wearing and replaces it with some of his dad's stuff. And part of that is like, it's quite sinister, because there's a line where she says she remembers him standing over his cousin. So she clearly knows what he's capable of. Some of it's funny. I mean, the fact that she just like buries it in the garden's kind of amusing, and he's like, oh my God, and the lads are all like, oh my God, your mum. But it's that thing about mothers protecting boys, and that's how it's like framed in there. So there's this sort of funny bit that she's like, you know, there's mud still on the bottom of her clothes when she does actually open the door to the police. But it's also that she knows that he is potentially capable of what he's been accused of, and she tries to protect him from that. And I mean, it becomes a big, it's one of the things that comes up much later on in the trial. But yeah, I mean, I thought she was fascinating for such a like tiny, she has such a tiny part in it, but such a sort of, it's both tiny and huge.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of at the time when you first read it, because that's not far into the book, you know, when she does go out and bury it, and she buries, it's not just like his phone and stuff like that. It's just like games consoles, right? Just lot, anything electronic, in the box, out you go, into the garden. And it's funny and it's done in a really funny way. But it comes back to something that comes up much later in the book about where Zara is talking about the expectations that are put on women within her family and in sort of the Muslim community, or the part of the Muslim community that she's grown up around. Oppression spreads when women like you tell their daughters to marry a certain man or wear a certain dress or work a certain job. It happens when women like you tell us gently and with all the love in the world not to peek above the parapet, instead to stay home, to be quiet, to be kind, to be good. And there's that, but the other side of that is actually that women then push their sons forward and push their sons out into the world and protect their sons when perhaps they should be made to have accountability for some of their actions. I'd read a whole book of Hassan's mum, actually. I want her to be in the sequel. Get her working with Zara. There's the double act we need.
Do you know what? I think if she works with Zara, what has come out of that is guilt and horror about what she'd done, I think. And I mean, all she's trying to do is the best for her kids, but yeah. It's not necessarily the best thing for either a kid or society.
Yeah, and that's the kind of tension at the heart of it, is that, you know, her actions are not out of any sort of badness, they're not out of any malevolence, they're not out of ill will. That is a mother trying to do the best thing for her son that she knows how. Mm. And that is... I think that's what this book does really well, is there are lots of sort of big issues. There's lots of nuance and, you know, the odd clumsy character aside, like the alcoholic mother. I think it's incredibly good at the different, you know, there are no or very few kind of straightforward good people, good, bad people. You know, there are people that do good and bad things on both sides of the situation, and I think it's very good at that sort of nuance, that things are really complicated. It's not as straightforward as this happened, this person says this happened, and this person says this happened, and actually the truth comes out in all the different cracks in all the different people's stories. I thought it was great at that.
Yeah, and I think actually you've just nailed, better than I did, what is wrong with the alcoholic mother is that she is just, she's one-dimensional.
Yeah.
And just going back to where sort of, it gives me a nice segue to what I was just thinking of when you were saying that about the nuances, that in terms of class, the class situation, of the four boys, two of them are working class and two are middle class. So Hassan and Amir. So Amir is the one really that's meant to be the ringleader of them all. His dad, there's a question mark over his dad's shady business. And he's obviously like very like dressed up and what have you. And Hassan's definitely like middle class. But Mo and Fareed, their parents have got working class jobs. One of them, does he own a shop?
One's a butcher.
Yep. And there's a lot about how many hours they're working, about how limited their English is. One of them's like not learned English at all, even though he's been in the country for quite a long time, because that he'd have to do that on top of working really long hours. And so that's not been something that he's prioritized. And there's a point where one of them talks about how this is going to impact differently on them too. He understands that they don't have the money and the glitz almost of that sort of sheen of respectability, and that the things are going to play out differently for them, that this is going to ruin their lives, and that's it. And one of those is the one who we know right from the beginning didn't do anything, that everybody says he was a spectator rather than a participant. And so that's a... Yeah, that was done really well, I thought. The way that she brought out the different ways they were going to be treated.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
I think the other thing that we need to talk about as well, which you mentioned at the beginning, is the role of the media, because it is horrific. And I mean, it's done really well. But I think if you were not British, And maybe, I think probably America's the only place I can think of that has a similar sort of press, that if you were reading that, you would just be like, what the fuck? You know, the stuff that they print, the way that they hounds the people involved, it ends up with like far more serious consequences because of it, like horrendous consequences for Zara at one point, and obviously also for Jody when they, you know, they're outside the door, she can't, and the houses of the boys, and you know, you could, they say to Jory, and we know this from, you know, trials that have taken place, that they can't pay any attention to what's happening. But when you are like, when social media is a thing and it's like such, you know, the society is saturated with commentary about it, then how do you as a juror stay away from that? Like, it's an impossible task, really. And so they're on trial by media, and the media are making the decisions. So, and it, I think she did a really good job of bringing across just how horrific that is, and how, you know, it's got fuck all to do with fuck all, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've talked so much about the novel being full of nuance, and one thing the press, certainly the tabloid press, certainly other bits of the press as well, is particularly lacking is nuance. And you know, they do, they inflame tensions, they you know, they insinuate various things about various people involved in the trial. They just, it becomes it turns it into a spectator sport, basically. And our press, I mean, our media has been horrendous at that, I mean, for years. You know, years and years. I mean, even now, phone hacking's back in the news and so on and so forth. It does, I think it does the press really, really well. I tell you, the one bit I didn't buy, though, is when Jody starts quoting Atticus Finch.
Yeah, I did find there was a bit when I thought, this is not a 16-year-old girl. She doesn't sound like a 16-year-old.
No. I mean, it did set up a very funny line, which I presume is why it's there. With a soft smile spread on Jodie's lips. Atticus Finch, I didn't expect sentimentality from you. Zara smiled too. He was one of the good ones. I'm not sure how many there are left in the world today. Lawyers or men, asked Jodie. Zara sighed. Both. It's a good line.
Yeah. No, I think there was another, I can't remember where it was now, but I think there was another point where I thought, yeah, she doesn't quite sound like a 16-year-old, but niggly, it's a debut.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's just being really pernickety. I think it's a really, really good thriller. I think I will definitely read more by her. I want to read more Zara, actually. Zara, I think, is a really intriguing sort of main character to come back. And it's, as we were saying before, you know, I feel like legal thrillers, that they have the sort of due a comeback, I think. I feel like the sort of heyday of legal thrillers was like John Grisham in the 90s, you know, the Firm and the Pelican Brief and all that sort of stuff. So I think we're probably due a return of the legal thriller, and it is really nice to see something that's not a white man.
Yeah, I do love a legal thriller. And I mean, apologies, because this is like white, but I was thinking about this when I'd read this book, actually, and what got me into it, because I love a legal thriller, actually, and what got me into it was when I was a kid. So the cinema in the town where I grew up in has got one screen. And so if you wanted to go to the pictures, you were going to see the one thing that they were showing. And sometimes me and one of my friends would just go and see whatever was on. Which meant that I went to see A Few Good Men knowing nothing about it, and A Few Good Men radicalized me into into legal thrillers, because, like, what a legal thriller to start with.
Yeah.
It's one of the best.
I saw that on stage in the early 2000s with Rob Lowe playing the Tom Cruise character. And do you remember Bad Girls, TV series set in a women's prison?
Yes.
And there was this, there was a prison guard called Jim Fenner, who was like the villain of the piece, and he played the Jack Nicholson character. And it was Saran Jones that played, is it Demi Moore that's in the film?
Yes.
Yeah.
I love Saran Jones. I saw her in Carol Churchill's Top Girls and she was amazing.
Oh, she's so good. Yeah. She's so good. We like her. Anyway, yeah, I think my first legal thriller, I saw Primal Fear when I was far too young to watch it.
Good.
And I loved it.
Good. Oh, it is good. I only watched that recently. It shit me up.
It's scary.
It is. And it's fucking terrifying.
And I was about 11 when I watched it on a plane.
Oh, my God.
It was on a plane.
There is no wonder you're in some fucked up shit, my friend.
And I just curse it
like horror.
I know. Yeah, I thought it was amazing. Oh, well, earlier than that, my mum accidentally let me watch The Omen when I was 10. not really knowing what it was. And it's like, it's called The Omen, Mum. What was your first clue? yeah, no, she let me watch The Omen, and it scared me so much, but I was fascinated by it. Mm. And that was the kind of thing that made me go, oh, this is horrible and really scary. It's when the bit comes off falls off the church roof, the spiry thing, and impales the priest. and it was the most horrifying / terrifying thing I'd ever seen, but I couldn't stop thinking about it, and I was completely fascinated. And that is probably the root of it.
I just want to point out to everyone listening, because you didn't get the joy that I've just had of Kirsty acting out the priest being impaled. We've got like arms spread and everything. It was great.
Yeah. I think about it surprisingly often.
Anyway.
I'm well adjusted.
Talking of well adjusted women.
Talking of well-adjusted women, the other book we're talking about today is The Khan by Simon Meer, which was published it's One World. It's their crime imprint on One World, which came out in 2021 and is out in paperback now. I really, really enjoyed this. This is a different sort of thriller. This is a kind of gangland Godfather. Now, I've not seen The Godfather, but you pointed out there's lots of kind of Godfather inspired scenes and things. And the basic story is Jia Khan is the daughter of Akbar Khan, who is the Khan. And the Khan is actually, it's a title given to rulers, but has become a sort of surname. But in this sense, is also the title of the head of this organized crime syndicate, basically, that is run through the family and sort of other families it's in Bradford in the area, and they essentially run the city. They run the drugs, they run the sex, they run there's obviously like protection rackets, there's all of everything is the police know, there's sort of various sort of nods and winks and understandings with the police. Gia has walked away from the family business, as it were, walked away from her family some years prior. She's a lawyer as well. She's gone to London. She's working as a defence lawyer, and she is coming back to Bradford for a family wedding, and this is the first time she's been back in some years, certainly since we find out that quite early on that her brother Zan has been killed in circumstances that don't become clear until a bit later on. Also returning to Yorkshire is her ex-husband Ilyas, who is a journalist who is back working on a local newspaper. So basically lots of disparate people are kind of coming back to Yorkshire, coming back to Bradford. And while we're there, Akbar, the Khan, is shot and killed. And essentially, Gia has to decide whether she's going to continue with her life down in London or whether she is stepping into her father's shoes and taking on the mantle of the Khan. There you go.
There we go. We're done. Sorted.
That's what it's about. Discuss.
I'm going to start with something massively controversial.
Mm.
I didn't think it was long enough. I can't remember a time I've ever said that about a book before. And I think it's partly because, as you mentioned, so it starts with, she ends up back in, so Gia ends up back in Yorkshire because her sister's getting married. And so she has promised that she's still quite close to her sister, and she's promised that she will go to the wedding. And if you've seen The Godfather, which I know you haven't, Kirsty, but loads of people listening will have done. So the like opening of The Godfather, it is Don Corleone's daughter's wedding. And people turn up wanting their wanting things granted that morning. And one of the first lines that Marlon Brando gets to say is, "You come to me on my daughter's wedding day," blah, 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 blah. And she practically like rehashes that exact sentence quite early on. So I felt like I was set up for a really complex, and it is a really complex, you know, mafia story essentially. And for me, it felt like there were gaps in bits where I could quite easily have had more, loads more. Like if it had been 700 pages, I would have been a happy woman, and I don't say that very often. But there was stuff like, so like when Gia makes the decision to stay, so they've buried her dad, and then she's staying in Yorkshire, but there's never really a, like, that decision's never sort of worked through, it just sort of happens. And then she does go back to London with her sister, but they just got a bit of a shopping trip. And it's not quite that straightforward. She's obviously been conducting other business while she's there, but it still felt a bit like it had been glossed over a bit. And the thing that you didn't mention that we find out quite early on as well is that she had a child with Elias, and she was told that the child was dead, and he's bought a had up. And I wanted more of their, I wanted loads more of their relationship, because it was great. Like when they, you know, because he is, he's 16 as well, and he's just not having it. When she walks back into his life, he's just like, "What the fuck are you doing?" And there's a brilliant scene where he just gives it to her both barrels, like, you know, "This is what it's been like for me. You can't even like talk to me properly," and And yeah, I wanted loads more of that, because I think partly because as the book goes on, the type of person she is revealed more. It's a bit like taking layers off an onion, where you get to the, like, there's all this really interesting stuff about, again, she's another one who's sort of described as being quite cold, and she's distant, and And one of the reasons that she says she's not had anything to do with Ayad, even though she knew he was alive, was that she's like, she can't cope with the idea of being a mother, that it'd be too much for her. She don't know what to do emotionally. She sort of gets stripped away and stripped away, and the relationship with her son humanizes her. So I wanted more of that against this type of person that you see her revealed as the book goes on. Because it gives that contrast to not necessarily who she's become, who she's always been. I don't want to give too much away.
I'm trying to think how to word this without any spoilers, because, you know, the reveals and the twists and so on are actually, I think, are really, really well done in this book. We've talked a lot over various episodes of this podcast about clunky twists and reveals and just like, "Oh, I saw that coming a mile off." And I think this, and take it back to an extent as well, I think these are two thrillers where there are twists that I genuinely didn't expect. And it's so rare, I feel like, at the moment, to you know, not see things like trundling down the track towards you. So I really, really don't want to spoil anything for anyone, because they're both great reading experiences, I think. But I do think, in terms of her relationship with her son, there are things that you learn about Gia as the novel goes on that actually, they sort of do two things at the same time. They both humanize her, but they also reveal the lengths she will go to for that family connection. And she talks a lot about, all the way through the book, as is, I think, you know, to be expected of a kind of gangland family, organized crime type thing, you know, there's lots of talk of bloodline, there is lots of talk about family and the family reputation and responsibility and honor, lots of talk of honor. You know, she says at one point, you know, that her bloodline is a burden to her. But actually, her actions at various points, both in the novel and in the past, which you learn about, they reveal the ways that that idea of honour and bloodline has sort of coalesced in her to do some quite shocking things at various points. There's a bit where she's explaining, you know, the way that they reconcile both her and her father, and they're very similar in certain ways. Really near the novel, near the beginning of the novel, you get a chapter, a fairly long chapter, that is sort of from Akbar's perspective, and it's giving some of his backstory and so on and so forth. But the way that he reconciles the fact that he's a devout Muslim, he absolutely believes in Allah, he's honors him in all of the ways, but yet also has this, because he is a criminal, because he has done some, you know, awful things, murder, drugs, prostitution, you know, all of those things. But the way he reconciles it, and the way that he has a clear conscience, is that he does these things for the greater good. So because of his actions, it means that, you know, local family businesses are flourishing, people are feeding their families. You know, he has, you know, if there is local families in dire need, he's been able to help them and sort them out and make sure that people have food on the table and make sure that people are safe and protected, and, you know, the kids have toys and, you know, all of this sort of stuff. And so that is his sort of balance sheet, is that, yes, I have done some despicable things, but I have done them for good intention, and good has come from it. And you have to have sinners so that you can have saints. And Gia, as much as she tries to distance herself from her family and the family business and her father's actions, actually, that sort of mindset and that sort of reconciliation comes very naturally to her. It's all for the greater good.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that I sort of like most about her. And of course, this is me coming from my education background, is that as soon as she's sort of in an interim role for a while, where she steps in because her brother's, her younger brother is otherwise engaged, shall we say, at that point. But the first thing she does is sets up all these schemes to support the local kids, because she says one of the problems, because it's never mentioned that it's set in Bradford, but it's set in Bradford. And there are, in terms of that idea of where you fit in, it feels very similar to Barnsley, but in a, like, obviously Barnsley is like majority white, whereas this is majority Asian. But same idea that if you then get an education and you go away, that you end up coming back because you don't fit in where you've gone, because you're from a very particular town or city where your differences stand out so much in a middle class world. And actually you go back and you stand out then because you've got an education. But what she tries to do then is go, well, I can reconcile these two things. And how I reconcile this is that I set up this scheme where we pay for these kids to be able to do the things that they want to do. We upskill them. And then if they want to, they can come and work for us. And of course they're going to want to, because they're going to stay loyal to the people who've provided that opportunity. And then they end up working on the dark web for them up to all sorts of, so they get really highly skilled people because of that investment. But there's that sort of, and I mean, it is that very sort of typical mafia looking after families type thing that you get in The Godfather, which is obviously based on the Italian Americans. But yeah, that sort of, it's that sense of community again, and how you build a community. And what they're doing, in one sense, is a really good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's,
you know, done for criminal
means. Bit of light murder.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's they're rivals, as it were. So they've got this you know, up and coming rival crime syndicate called mm-hmm. Brotherhood, and they're all kind of Eastern European, led by a guy called Novak, who is sort of starting to challenge the Khan and the Jirga, which is the kind of name of the organization essentially that is headed up by the Khan. And the Brotherhood are coming along, and they're trying to sort of stake their claim, and they're trying to muscle in on the Jirga's turf, essentially. But again, it's this idea of brotherhood and family, and you protect your own, and all this sort of stuff that I find really interesting in all of those sort of gangland type, you know, thrillers. That sort of you know, these codes of conduct, you know, the honor among thieves and all this sort of stuff. You know, it's their kind of moral codes are so incredibly strict, yet at the same time, you know, casual kneecapping.
But that's one of the things, isn't it, that causes the tension, is because Gia understands what this, well, that's how she ends up understanding her father better, is that she begins to understand what code is lived by, and that she also needs to follow this code, because she's now essentially managing a load of old men. And there's a brilliant scene, actually, which I'm going to find in a second and read, because I loved it. It's great. But yeah, so she comes to understand that code, and part of the problem with Novak and his guys is they don't have that code, and that and even the police have got a problem with that, because at that point it's causing chaos in the city because of the way that they're behaving.
There's a point where, you know, the chief of police tells the Jirga that they need to get the streets back under control. It's this sort of tacit acceptance that they are the ones that control the city, and actually they have it within their power to rein everyone in. It's just this sort of quiet understanding, and people will get helped out who needs helped out, and if someone needs to get bailed quickly, then we can organize that. At the same time, there's a, you know, implication that the son of the chief of police has been helped by the Jirga at certain points. It's all that sort of, again, family, honor, you've done me a good deed, I'll do you a good deed, you know, kind of under the counter deals, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. Just going back to this bit then, where she takes over, and she obviously has to sit in the meeting. There's a really funny bit as well, because she's vegan, and they serve her a plate of meat, because that's part of the like rules of it all. They're all arguing amongst themselves, and she knows she's got to take control of this. So it says, she looks at the old men who had built the family empire alongside her father, the men who owned the city and intimidated its inhabitants. She watched them spit and seethe and gird each other, unable to control their tongues and their tempers, and a calm came over her. She was better than this. She was smarter than them, and she had nothing to prove. Her voice even, her tone gentle, she looked at Janan Khan. You benefit from the business of women. If women stopped buying from and selling to men, then where would you be? She said. The room fell to a hush. We have not buried my father yet, and I have still to weep my share of tears, Lala. She moved forward, placing her hand on the old man's arm, knowing that calling him uncle had softened him a little. I was your Khan's favourite child, and this is how you repay him. Does his death and a woman's pain and honour mean so little to you? He had expected her to light the fuse, not pour sand on his vitriol. A look of shame flashed across his face, and in that moment, Gia knew she had him. She glanced around the room at the other men. She had watched them grow old, from fathers to grandfathers, and she understood that they were withering away and clinging to their views in the hope of remaining relevant. And I was like, isn't that the problem with old men, like, generally in society? this is part of where our entire problems stem from at the moment, is this, and actually some old white women as well, but this is where like quite a lot of problems are stemming from, that things are moving on and they don't want to accept it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I really liked that scene as well. That's one of my favorite scenes, and I liked that Gia didn't just sort of take control by replicating her father. You know, she has a different approach. She's obviously very good. I mean, she's been a lawyer. She's very good at reading body language. She's very good at understanding how to win an argument and how to work a room and et cetera, et cetera. But I like that she did things in her own way, in her sort of, I was going to say in her own womanly way, but that sounded very patronising. Very womanly.
Well, one of the questions of the book is about what sort of woman she is, isn't she? Because she's rejected motherhood when she's discovered that her kid is still alive. She chooses to take over from her father eventually. Like, you know, there is that question about, you know, what sort of woman are you? She doesn't fit within the rules of their codes. She doesn't fit within the rules of the society that she lives in London. She just, you know, to, even in terms of a lawyer, she's unusual. So, yeah, one of the, I enjoyed that as sort of one of the questions about what type of person she is.
Yeah, I mean, no one quite knows what to make of her, which is ultimately working in her favour. Because no one quite knows what to expect from her. So she can very easily wrong foot people. And it means also that people underestimate her a lot.
Yeah, even Elias, who has known her the longest and thinks that he knows who she is, gets a surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. But I thought it was a really excellent book, actually. And yeah, I could have read more too.
I hope there's more coming, because I would definitely read more of that.
And I do. I had a look at Simon Meer's website just before we started recording, and it does say that it has been optioned by BBC Studio. So it does look like we'll be getting TV version, which I will absolutely be here for. I thought it was great. I think they're two of the best thrillers I've read in quite a long time.
Ooh, praise indeed.
Praise indeed.
So what we're reading next week, Kirsty Dool?
What we're reading next week, we're reading a book with a very long title. We're reading We Go Around in the Night and Are Consumed by Fire by Jules Grant, and we are reading The Falconer by Dana Chapnick.
Bit of coming of age stories.
Bit of coming of age stories. We're just going to have to use that title in short form, because I'm not saying We Go Around in the Night and Are Consumed by Fire every time I say something about the book.
We can just go fire, and you can
fire!
Put your hands up, like, you know, there's an issue.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll amuse us. Nobody else will be able to see it, but we'll be entertained.
But we make ourselves laugh. That's the main thing.
Well, somebody's got to.
True.
In the meantime, then, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. We are also both on Twitter, sometimes talking about books, sometimes talking nonsense, sometimes just wondering what's going on with the whole political situation. Kirsty is at The Other Kirsty, and I am at Naomi Frisby. We will see you next week. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.